Banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers on the earth, take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with a flick of a pen, they'll create enough money to buy it back again. Take this great power away from them, and all great fortunes, like mine, will disappear. And they ought to disappear, for then this would be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to remain the slaves of the bankers and pay for the cost of your own slavery, then continue to allow the banks to create money and control credit. That quotation was taken from a talk given to a group of college professors at the University of Texas in Houston in 1922. The speaker was Sir Josiah Stamp. At that time, Sir Josiah Stamp was considered the second richest man in England, and he owned the Bank of England. So much for his credentials. This is going to be a talk about money. It will come to you in 6 separate programs. During these programs, I will endeavor to explain to you why we all need to have a better understanding of our monetary system. I will cover the mechanics of money, how it gets created, how it gets destroyed. You will learn a little history of money. You'll see the consequences of our present monetary system and some of the solutions for a more sustainable financial structure. As for the solutions, hopefully you all will come up with better answers than I give, or at least other responses. I'll give list of materials where you can find a lot more than I am able to tell you, more than I even know. Maybe with a better understanding of money, we can give to our descendants a more even-handed and equitable life. Don't think this is only about the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System will be mentioned a lot, but the Federal Reserve System is just a name. Remember that old canard, a rose by any other name would still smell as sweet? The system we'll talk about is fractional reserve banking. Now, I will repeat myself from time to time, but hopefully not too often. I will from time to time insult your intelligence. Sorry about that. This is not going to be Economics 101. It's actually a kindergarten class on money. This dissertation is not going to make anyone an expert. It is designed to give to the average John or Jane Doe a better understanding of the procedures involved in generating and demolishing our money supply. Our talk is not fine-tuned. It is an overall view of the subject. Hopefully, it will give the average listener an idea of the type of people we need in our government in order to change the system. Only our Congress, meaning the House and Senate, can change it. It's up to us to choose the right people to do the job. And we probably would, if we are ever given the choice. Having a pencil and a piece of paper handy while listening will be quite helpful for you. There will be figures used which you may want to look at in order to help clarify some points, and you may want to take notes so you can email me later. You know, many times investors and economists often chat about the money supply and refer to it as M1, M2, or M3. For our discussion, the money supply is not important. We will probably only mention M1. M1 is all physical money like coin, currency, checking accounts, and now accounts. Now accounts are negotiable orders of withdrawal accounts, and that is what we use for electronic transfers. The relationship between various measures of the money supply in the U.S. have been unstable, and using the money supply as a guide for the conduct of our monetary policy in the United States has diminished over time. So why even talk about money? There are many reasons to talk about money. There are more reasons than I can cover here. There are more reasons than I can even think of. More reasons than we all can even know. But here are a few of the reasons. You see, money is the power that has more impact on citizens' day-to-day lives than the legislative, the executive, and judicial branches of our government put together. It's really a fourth branch of government, or at least should be a fourth, even though our government has very little to do with our monetary system. Monetary decisions determine how money is made available in the community and who gets it, whether it finances industry, is available for more housing, or for much-needed infrastructure, or goes into speculation and other forms of corruption. It will determine levels of employment and unemployment, incomes, interest rates, and much more. It will decide whether there will be general economic justice or whether some groups will get special privileges. It will shape health care and education and even the arts. Here is one reason the monetary historian Alexander Del Mar gave as to why we should talk about money. He said that money is perhaps the mightiest engine to which man can lend an intelligent guidance. Unheard, unfelt, unseen, it has the power to so distribute the burdens, gratifications, and opportunities of life that each individual shall enjoy that share of them to which his merits or good fortune may fairly entitle him, or, contrawise, to dispense with them so partial a hand as to violate every principle of justice and perpetrate a succession of slaveries to the end of time. I've tried to design this talk for people who admit they don't understand the economics or the mechanics of money. If you're one of them, you're not alone. It's probably safe to say that 99% of the population is completely ignorant on the subject of money, credit, circulation, expansion, and destruction of our medium of exchange, what is commonly called money. Every day the media speaks of the price of gasoline, the mortgage rates, the unemployment that swept the nation, the cost of living index. The subjects go on and on, but they all revolve around one noun, money. But do we really understand money? Most of us who can read probably think we know what money is. I thought at one time that I did. But do we? Or have we simply been fooled into thinking we know what money is? Charles Reynolds was a magician's consultant, and he said this in Parade magazine back in 1980. You see, the more we are conditioned by education and just living in a society which teaches us to think along certain lines, the easier we are to fool. The magician encourages us to follow one logical path, the one we are accustomed to follow in a normal situation, while he, unknown to us, takes an entirely different one to accomplish his illusion. Thus, the hardest people in the world to fool are children, who take little for granted. The easiest are scientists. Money is a very hard subject to study. You can't make heads nor tails of it. You know, heads and tails on nickels, dimes, and quarters. That was a terrible pun, wasn't it? Oh, sorry about that. Anyway, the renowned economist John Kenneth Galbraith once said that the study of money, above all other fields in economics, is one in which complexity is used to disguise truth or to evade truth, not to reveal it. Why is understanding money so important? Is money itself important? Well, I feel about money kind of like Oscar Wilde felt about it when he said, quote, "When I was young, I used to think that money was the most important thing in life. Now that I'm older, I know it is. Let's see what the United States Silver Commission said about the importance of money way back in 1876. Money is the great instrument of association, the very fiber of social organization, the vitalizing force of industry, the protoplasm of civilization, and as essential to its existence as oxygen is to animal life. Jesus spoke more about money than he did about heaven and hell combined. 1 out of every 10 verses in the Gospels, 288 in all, deal directly with the subject of money. 16 of his 38 parables were concerned with how to handle money and worldly possessions. The Bible offers us 500 verses on prayer, less than 500 on faith, but over 2,000 verses on money and worldly possessions. Money touches everyone every day. It affects almost all facets of our life. It revolves around us so universally, so routinely, so minutely, so pervasively, that most of us take the issue of money for granted and only know that we wish we had more of it. A user of money may think that money comes into being either naturally or as a result of growth in the economy, or as a consequence of some government activity. But just how this happens all too often remains a mystery. Money is the one ingredient of our existence that can determine how well we can accumulate the necessities and pleasures of our being, the stuff that invigorates the days of our lives. The supply of money affects the general level of prices, which affects the standard of living. The cost of living index and the money supply run parallel. Now, since these preceding quotations may leave the listener with a negative taste in his mouth regarding money, this part of the program should close with Ralph Waldo Emerson's statement concerning money. He said that money, which represents the prose of life and which is hardly spoken of in parlors without an apology, is, in its effects and laws, as beautiful as roses. Being unacquainted with the monetary system is not an occurrence attributed only to modern man. It is national and timeless, too, at least in the United States. Looking at the history of the United States, we can find many instances where men have discussed how naive their fellow citizens have been on the subject of money. Our founding fathers saw how inexperienced their neighbors were when it came to the issue of our medium of exchange. Here are some examples. John Adams wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson, and in it he said, quote, "All the perplexities, confusion, and distress in America arises not from defects in their Constitution or Confederation, not from want of honor or virtue, so much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation." A Russian by the name of Ulyanov said that the best way to destroy the capitalist system is to debauch its currency. We know Ulyanov by another name, Vladimir Lenin. Henry Ford once said that if 10% of the people knew the corruption involved in our monetary system, there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning. And Paul Warburg, who is usually given the credit for writing the Federal Reserve Act, said, "Nothing is so universally used and so little understood as money." We can also go to President James Garfield, who said that whosoever controls the volume of money in a country is the absolute master of all commerce and all industry in that country. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled, one way or another, by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate. See, the subject of money is not hard to understand. Any 10-year-old could grasp its technicalities if he had been taught correctly at the beginning. Difficulties arise because we have been taught that our government has something to do with the amount of money circulating around the country and the world. In an indirect way, it does, but not like most people assume. The biggest misconception a great majority of us have about the creation of money is that when the government wants money, it turns on its printing presses. We'll discuss the government's printing press later. Money is such a convoluted subject. Why? Because no one seems to know what money is. About 30 years ago, Louis Rukeyser had a TV show on PBS television. It was called Moneyline. On one program, Louis was interviewing Robert McKenna, Jr., who was retiring from the Shearson Bank, which was a very large and prestigious firm. And Louis asked, "Is it then, Mr. McKenna, that we just don't know what money is today?" And Mr. McKenna replied, "We never did know." While the audience twittered rather nervously, he made it very clear that he wasn't kidding. We never did know what money is. A Yale professor of economics was once asked, "What is money?" His reply, "I don't know, but whatever it is, it should grow at the rate of 3% to 4% per year." Why would these two very well-educated men give such mundane answers to these two questions? Surely there is a better understanding of money than this. But if there is, why haven't we been told about it before? One would think that some experts at one time or another could tell us, but an article in the Wall Street Journal of September 24, 1971 said that there was an International Monetary Fund seminar of eminent economists and they couldn't agree on what money is or how banks create. See, the study of money has so many twists and coils and whirls and turns that its comprehension is hard to grasp for the average human being. One reason for its complexity may be because money has never been defined by law. Hard to believe, isn't it, that something so universally used has never been lawfully defined? Or maybe the main reason people do not understand money is because there is no such thing as money. We have never seen a money. But then, we have never seen a clothes or a furniture either. We have seen things we use as clothes, such as a shirt, a blouse, or a coat, and items we've used as furniture, such as a chair, a table, or a bed. But in and of themselves, there is no such thing as a clothes, a furniture, or a money. We have only used items as money. What have we used as money in the past? Well, salt was once used as money in ancient Rome. You still hear the expression today, "not worth his salt," meaning he is not worth his daily pay. If you have ever worked on a salary, the words salary and salt have the same Latin root, salarium. Cowrie shells were once used as money. As a matter of fact, cowrie shells were one of the first items used as money in international trade. Not only were they accepted throughout the world, they were almost impossible to counterfeit. At one time, tea was used as money in Manchuria, and opium was used as money in ancient China. Bales of tobacco were used as money in colonial Virginia. Notice that everything mentioned as being used as money in the past were commodities, tangible items, and they could claim a substance. Remember your 8th grade science class? A substance is either a gas, a liquid, or a solid. It might change from a gas to a liquid, or a solid to a gas, or a solid to a liquid, or any combination of the above, but you had to be able to identify a substance with one of your 5 senses. You had to be able to either see it, taste it, smell it, hear it, or touch it. Today in America, there is nothing, no thing, that we are using as money, expressed in dollars and cents, that can claim a substance. When they used tobacco as money in colonial Virginia, the citizens didn't go around carrying bales of tobacco on their back. They had receipts showing how much tobacco was in the tobacco barn or tobacco bank. If a citizen wanted a pair of boots the cobbler had made, he would ask about the price of the boots. The bootmaker might say he wanted 5 bales of a certain type of tobacco. The customer would then sign over a receipt for the amount of tobacco to the cobbler. Were these receipts used as money? No. The receipts were used as a substitute for what was used as money. What was used as money in colonial Virginia? Tobacco. Throughout recorded history, most people think that nothing has been used as money as much as gold and silver. Whenever we use anything as money, it is called monetizing. Monetizing means to coin or fashion as money. When the Chinese used opium as money, they monetized opium. When the colonists of early Virginia used tobacco as money, they monetized tobacco. When gold and silver were used as money, gold and silver were monetized. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York tells me that now we are monetizing debt. Say at one time we could go out and dig up some gold ore and monetize it into gold money, or we could go out and dig up some silver ore and monetize it into silver money. Perhaps this weekend we could all go out and dig up some debt ore and monetize it into debt money. What is debt? Black's Law Dictionary gives the definition taken from a legal case of the State versus DeSay. In that case, the courts define debt as a sum of money due. What are we using as money? We are using debt as money. What is debt? Black's Law Dictionary defines debt as a sum of money due. We are now using a sum of money due as money. Can we pay our bills with a sum of money due? Because if we do, then it is no longer due. And if it is no longer due, then it is no longer money, because money is a sum of money due. No wonder we never understood economics. It never made any sense, did it? Now, that statement, you can't pay your bills with a sum of money due, is not as flippant as it appears. We are using a debt instrument as money, and we cannot pay our bills with a debt instrument. The law has already ruled on debt payment and debt discharge. That was in the case of Stannis versus White. There the law stated that there is a distinction between a debt discharged and one paid. When discharged, the debt still exists, though divested of its character as a legal obligation during the operation of the discharge, something of the original vitality of the debt continues to exist, which may be transferred even though the transferee takes it subject to the disability incident to the discharge. The fact that it carries something which may be a consideration for a new promise to pay, so as to make an otherwise worthless promise to pay a legal obligation, makes it the subject of transfer by assignment. That is now the law. Since we cannot pay off the mortgage at the bank with a debt instrument, therefore, we cannot own property that is free and clear. Property ownership that is free and clear is called allodial ownership. It existed in this country at one time, but now you will very seldom even find the word allodial in the dictionary. Allodial ownership has been replaced with ownership inequity. You see, to own is to possess, the having, holding, or detention of property in one's own power to command, and he may exercise that power at his pleasure to the exclusion of all others. William Pitt the Elder probably expressed it best. when he was speaking about the colonies and his admiration for them, when he said that the poorest man in his cottage can bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter. All of his forces dare not cross the threshold of the ruined cottage. This is an example of allodial ownership. It is also one of Thomas Jefferson's favorite quotes. We have no power over our property today. We must get permission from some form of government to add a room or to cut down a tree. The list can go on, depending on where you live. Karl Marx's first plank on his Communist Manifesto was the abolition of property in land and application of all rents of land to public purposes. This vision of Karl Marx is being realized through the magic of our debt form of money. Allodial is not found in Funk and Wagnall's New Desk Dictionary. We are told that we have all these property rules and regulations out of necessity. What is necessity? To quote William Pitt again, necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. Money is created in one of two ways. It is either spent into circulation or it is loaned into circulation. No matter which way it is created, it all begins and ends with the Federal Reserve Bank and its many commercial bank branches. We should enter a little footnote here. Since the Depository Institution Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, all depository institutions, not just commercial banks, have the potential for creating money. This does not mean that they all can create money. It means that there is the possibility that they may create money. For the purposes of explaining this elementary presentation of our monetary system, I'll only use the term commercial banks or just banks. I will not include savings and loans, credit unions, or insurance companies. Money is spent into circulation when a Federal Reserve Bank writes an unbounceable check against absolutely no funds in order to pay its bills, such as its light bill, phone bill, or wages. This is how money is spent into circulation. Money also comes into existence when a Federal Reserve Bank or one of its many commercial bank branches grants a loan to an individual, a business, a corporation, or any branch of government. This is how money is loaned into circulation. According to the book Modern Money Mechanics, published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, 97% of our money supply is loaned into circulation and is generating interest. What is the consequences of a system which uses mostly borrowed interest-bearing money? Perpetual debt. I know some of you are probably thinking, no, if all of us, including big corporations, paid more taxes, we could pay off the national debt. You're probably right. But as you will learn, if we were to pay off the national debt, we would still be in hock. The debt would cease to be both private and public, which is what it is now, and would become only private debt owed to the banks. But the way the system is designed, we would have no basis or starting point for making money. We need federal public debt to use as reserves for the private debt that is created by private borrowing. Now, this system all got started with fractional reserve banking. Let me repeat this phrase, fractional reserve banking. Remember it. This is the master plan that our monetary system is designed on. On our next show, we'll discuss fractional reserve banking. Thanks so much for listening.